now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Nicknamed the most beautiful woman in Alaska, 31-year-old Diane Wells was bruised and bloodied when she screamed for help in the early hours of October 17, 1953. Her husband, Cecil, a wealthy Fairbanks businessman, had been shot dead, and she claimed they were the victims of a brutal home invasion. Blonde, glamorous, and 20 years younger than Cecil, police were immediately suspicious of Diane's account, and the investigation soon turned toward her alleged lover, black musician Johnny Warren, who had left town the night of the murder. The scandal hit the pages of Newsweek, Life, Jet, and the pulp detective magazines, and nearly 70 years later, journalist James T. Bartlett uncovers new evidence, including an unpublished memoir, unseen photographs, and re-examines the FBI files. He tracks down and interviews the people close to Cecil, Diane, Johnny, and the mysterious third suspect, dance instructor William Columbany, to reveal the story of the most notorious and baffling murder in the history of Fairbanks. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Alaskan Blonde, Sex, Secrets, and the Hollywood Story That Shocked America, with my special guest, journalist and author, James T. Bartlett. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, James T. Bartlett.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. What brought you to this story and why you decided to become involved?
I'll give you the very short version. I work as a journalist. I live here in Los Angeles, but obviously I'm from England originally. And I had written a couple of guides to Los Angeles that featured true crime in them. They were sort of true crime guides to some famous buildings and restaurants and hotels and so forth. And this particular murder in Fairbanks was one of the crimes that I found out about while I was researching this book. It had a connection to the crime, and I wrote the entry for the book, and I never really quite forgot about it. And I started to look into the story because, as some of the readers might see if they read the book, you know, the pictures of Diane Wells, she was so glamorous, and it was such a 50s film noir story that I just assumed, after I'd read some of the newspaper reports, that there must be a book. And I thought, I want to read that book. I want to find out what happened. And then I found out there was no book. And then I found out there wasn't really anything other than the newspaper coverage at the time. But the newspaper coverage at the time was quite extensive, all the way across America, in other countries as well, in the UK, in Australia. It got as far as that. And I realized that it was quite a sensational story from what was then a territory. Alaska was a territory then. It was not part of the US.
Right.
And people really didn't know a lot about Alaska, myself included. And that just sent me off down a rabbit hole to try and find out what happened, not only with the murder, which was never solved, but also what happened to the people, even specifically the young son that Cecil and Diane Wells had. They had a young son who was, of course, you know, an orphan by the age of four.
Right.
And I wanted to find out what happened to him, just purely, I guess, out of curiosity. And because it was such a big story, I assumed there would be something somewhere about it, even though it was 70 years ago. And there wasn't. And then the first contacts I managed to make through Google and through Facebook were with a couple of family members. And what I found out very quickly was that nearly all the family members who were involved, that would be Cecil's family, he'd been married four times previously. He had a number of children. And Diane, who had been married previously before, she also had two children as well from a previous marriage. And the Johnny Warren, who you mentioned, who was charged alongside Diane with the murder, he had been married several times. I didn't know whether he had any children and so forth. And I did speak to some of them, and they all came back to me and said, we really don't know what happened. It was really sort of brushed under the carpet. We never really found out what happened, even amongst the families privately. They really had no idea what had happened and felt that it had been just forgotten as a story. But of course, it had had repercussions forever because, you know, the children were now grown up adults with grandchildren of their own, and they weren't able to tell their grandchildren much, you know, about their parents or their grandparents because it just wasn't simply talked about. You know, it was the 1950s, and a lot of them just said, well, I think, you know, that my grandmother killed my grandfather. You know, that was the limit of what some of them knew. And that just got me into the story to try and find out initially for myself out of curiosity, but then more so for the family members as I talked to more and more to get some sort of idea of what might have happened and why.
Let's go back to what you did find about this A-list couple, as you refer to them, Cecil and Diane Wells. And you talk about Cecil Moore Wells, which was 50 years old at that time. Tell us about his ex-marriages and his children and his stakes in real estate and other things. Tell us a little bit about who Cecil Wells was.
Yeah, Cecil Wells, that was part of the thing that interested me because he was a very important and influential person within the whole of Alaska, not just within Fairbanks. He was what they would call a pioneer in the early days of Alaska or territorial Alaska. He had been married. He'd been married four times before he met Diane. And Diane was very different to his previous four wives. She was very much younger, 20 years younger. She's very glamorous. And as pretty much everybody said to me, she was very much the trophy wife. It seemed to be a very quick romance, a quick marriage. But he was extremely influential within initially Anchorage. And then further in Fairbanks, he had an enormous amount of contracts and associations with some of the major motor manufacturers. So it was General Motors and Chevy. And this is not just cars. It would also be industrial machines and tractors. So he was a big player within that. He was also an investor, very much so within Fairbanks, which at the time was a small city. You know, it's a small city now, but it was very small then. So he was involved in the very famous hot springs that they have in Fairbanks. He'd also invested in some of the first developments in Hawaii, an apartment building complex, which still got built. It still exists today. He was an investor in that. He was a big flag waver locally. He was involved in the Chamber of Commerce. He flew a lot across Alaska because Alaska was trying to become a state. And that involved a lot of meetings over many years. And so he was enormously important and influential. So when he was, you know, shot in his bed, in his house, that was a big scandal. It was a big crime. And there had been a couple of similar other crimes in Fairbanks in recent months. And it looked like crime was a real problem. Crime's always a problem anywhere in most cities, as we know. But when you have a territory that's trying to become a state, one of the things that they look to is law and order and crime. And if famous wealthy businessmen are getting murdered in their beds or getting murdered by robbers in their houses, that doesn't look particularly good. And so his murder was a huge deal within Alaska. I mean, the day after his murder, Anchorage Airport was opening, which is the biggest airport in Alaska, I think, still. And it wasn't the front page news. His murder was the front page news in Anchorage. His murder was more important than the international airport opening.
Let's talk about October 17th, 1953, because you talked about this murder. At 7:15 a.m., Diane is banging on a neighbor's door, Alice Orahood. What does she tell Alice, and what is the condition of Diane, according to Alice?
She's battered and bloody and bruised. She's definitely been, something's happened to her for sure. She's hysterical. She bangs on her neighbor's door, which is right opposite, just in a corridor. This isn't in a housing. They lived in a building that's still there called the Northwood Building. It's an eight-story skyscraper, they called it then. It was and still is one of the tallest buildings in Fairbanks. He banged on her door and she says to the neighbor, call the police. Cecil's been hurt. The police arrive very quickly. The police station isn't far. Like I said, it's a small city. This is within downtown. And she tells the police that two men broke in late at night in the early hours. She woke up in bed. There were two men standing in the doorway. She tried to get out. One of them grabbed her, bashed her over the head. She fell unconscious. She heard some noises. And when she woke up, Cecil had been shot in the bed. Money had been taken. Jewelry had been taken. the house was the apartments. They were two apartments, actually joined apartments, was in a state, and Cecil was dead. And that was when she ran for help.
You talk about the evening before police ask her, this Danforth, and you can introduce this Evie Danforth and the people that begin to speak to Diane, because that's the first account that they have. Tell us about what she said in terms of what happened the evening before and who they were with.
Yes, so they were obviously, after the initial police officer arrived, the chief of police, who was Evie Danforth, Everett, his name was, he was pretty new in the job. He was, of course, came around to the apartment and was in charge of the investigation. So he's the Fairbanks Police Department. It gets, like many murder cases do, starts to involve a lot of agencies. And he knew straight away that this was a huge deal. You know, Cecil Wells, but everyone knew who he was. This was going to be a big case. It's a career case. And he talks to Diane and he talks about what's happening. And she gave a statement. She spoke to the newspapers, and it was reported several times that the previous evening, she and Cecil had been out to see a movie. They'd gone out for drinks before they'd gone out to see a movie. They'd had a late dinner guest who was a friend of Cecil's, Herbert Mansing, his name was. He'd have been a late dinner guest. He left at about 11 o'clock. And then she said that Cecil had gone to bed. She'd stayed up to read for a bit and then had gone to bed herself. One of the important things, without trying to get too much into the details, but it was considered evidence, was that she said during the night she felt ill. And she was sick. She vomited. She, you know, vomited on either, I guess, in the toilet or on her pajamas anyway, or her nightdress, and took them off and changed into a set of Cecil's pajamas. She said that happened during the night. And then there was the home invasion, which was, she said, it was two men. She couldn't tell anything about them. They were dressed in black. They had black gloves on, masks on. She couldn't tell anything about them at all. So when she was being questioned the next day, she was told that Cecil was dead, but she didn't believe it. She kept insisting that he'd be taken to hospital, but the doctor came and immediately declared him dead, tried to treat her, told her that she needed to go to hospital. She went to hospital. And again, the hospital is very close by, just across the River Chena. She was taken to hospital. A friend of hers walked over the bridge to meet her at the hospital. And they basically took her statement once she had recovered in the hospital. And she said pretty much what I've said before, but there were certain things about the crime scene that we would certainly now think would possibly didn't add up so much. Like Cecil's wallet was outside on the street, which might make sense if, you know, it had been stolen, but it was empty. It was right out on the street. There was like a sleeping cap, you know, that people used to wear back. His cap was outside. And it just seemed to be a little less than convincing from the beginning, mainly because, as I point out in the book, you know, that they were on the eighth floor of the Northwood building. And usually burglars don't go to the top floor of a building to randomly try and get into an apartment building. They're going to stay usually on the ground floor so that they can get away quickly. For example, the police extensively questioned the neighbors, all the people on that floor, some of the people on the floor underneath. And as witness statements and witness gathering often does, revealed some other things about the Wells, Cecil and Diane Wells, and about their life together and what the neighbors had seen and heard, both on the night of the murder and also at other times. And that seemed to indicate that perhaps Cecil and Diane had a bit of a rocky marriage, perhaps, that there had been reports and the neighbors told stories of rows, possibly more than rows happening, a lot of screaming, their son, whose name was Mark, crying. They'd heard the son crying a lot. And it just seemed to be that possibly Danforth and the other investigating officers, there was also a US Marshal, Frank Worth, who became quite important to the story later. They searched for the weapon. They couldn't find it, although they found other guns in the apartment. You know, this was Alaska. It's very, very common, even now, for people to have guns. That's not unusual. But they didn't require licensing or registering at the time. But they found a couple of guns in the apartment, but not the gun that had fired the bullet that killed Cecil. When they took the body away, they were, you know, in Cecil, in his head. It was a shot straight to the side of the head from relatively close range. And they found another bullet later, which was a little problematic for the investigation because it was found, you know, in the bed. And, you know, they should have found that initially, but they never managed to find. And they tried the actual case or the case file, the FBI file that I got, ran up until late 1960, which is 6-7 years after the murder. And they tried several times. They sent several guns that they found in Fairbanks. There was one that they found in the basement of a club. There was one, there were two that I don't know where they came from, but they were tested. There was another one that they found at length from somebody who they said had sold and bought a weapon. And it was possible that Johnny Warren, the black musician who was allegedly Diane Wells' lover, he may have owned that gun at the time. They tested all these guns. All the guns came back as not being the one that matched the weapon. And they had enough evidence from the casings to be able to match the gun to the bullet, but they never found the gun.
You talk about this investigation by Danforth, and he, right off the hop, does not believe Diane's account whatsoever. So tell us how it is that they find out or hear about this Johnny Warren, and tell us a little bit more about Johnny Warren. And he's a musician, but tell us a little bit more about how, what this relationship is supposed to entail and where they get this information from.
Yes. Johnny Warren was born in Mississippi. He was the same age as Diane, a little bit older. And he was a musician, a local musician, a really good musician. He was a career musician and gigging musician who tended to gig right up and down the west coast of the States, traveling a lot as a musician. But he spent a lot of time in Fairbanks and Alaska generally as a musician because, like a lot of towns in Alaska at the time, especially, there was a lot of money flying around, especially in Fairbanks. You know, there was a very large military population, a lot of contractors, a lot of miners as well. So there's still gold and mineral mining going on and various other heavy industries. So there were a lot of men in Fairbanks, a lot, heavily outnumbered the female population. And that meant lots of bars and lots of drinking and lots of entertainment. And usually at that time, an entertainment meant there was a live band. And so Johnny Warren was one of these musicians. He got a lot of work. He played a lot of instruments, even sang as well. But Danforth, Danforth didn't get the call. It was actually Frank Worth, who was a U.S. Marshal. He got a call, a tip-off. I found out later during my research who it was from, but he got an anonymous tip-off, or at least the tip-off wasn't mentioned as to who it was, saying that the police needed to look into Diane Wells and maybe her connection to Johnny Warren. And then it emerged that Johnny had certainly been seen the night of the murder, you know, as a lot of other people had been, but he'd actually left town the night of the murder. And that was something that seemed to, as I'm sure it would to anyone, certainly to Chief of Police Danforth, that seemed suspicious. And they put out an arrest on the wire, but be on the lookout for him and his car, because he had left Fairbanks that night and he was driving all the way down to Oakland in California, which is, it's a very long way. And I know we might think, well, why didn't he take the train? Or, you know, why didn't he fly? This is the 1950s. Yet none of that was an option. I mean, driving even wasn't the best option, but mainly the way to get around Alaska and a lot of the cases now is still to fly. So he drove down and they were looking for him straight away. But by the time that had gone out, he was already into Canada and away. So that looked somewhat suspicious, but they have no proof that they had a relationship of any kind. And that was the interesting thing specifically, or at least almost the most scandalous thing, was that the suggestion that, you know, she was a married white woman, married to a very influential white businessman, would be having an affair with a black man who was also married. That was almost more of a scandal than the actual murder. And that was what the police especially were very keen to try and prove, to prove a connection between the two of them. And as indeed they did, or at least they certainly felt they had enough, because just a couple of weeks after the murder, Diane and Johnny were both indicted for the murder of Cecil Wells, which sounds logical. But of course, as Diane's lawyer pointed out immediately, how can two people be indicted for one, you know, for a gunshot? You know, they both didn't have their fingers on the trigger. It was, but they were both indicted together. And as the story progressed, and as the arrest warrants went out, Johnny was actually, he went voluntarily to the police in Oakland, where he was at his sister's house. It was an innocent trip. He'd actually gone with several other people. It was just coincidental. And he spoke to the police at length and very much clearly confirmed that he and Diane Wells were in a relationship, had been in a relationship. And they had met a number of times at the apartment in the Northwood building. also at another place called the Polaris Building, which is also still there, although it's about to be demolished in Fairbanks. That was in the apartment of a friend of Johnny's. He let them meet there. Now, they obviously, this was the 1950s and they didn't use terms, but intimate relations was the term that was used. And there were also, which I put some of them in the book, and they were in the FBI files and they were mentioned in court. There was also some letters that Diane had sent to Johnny. And, you know, they showed that she was obviously very keen on him and was quite smitten. The question of whether it was reciprocated didn't really seem to matter. The fact is that became more of the focus than almost the murder, because Danforth and the other investigating agencies, which were the marshals and the territorial police, they began to see fairly clearly early on. They began to certainly move in the direction that this looks like most domestic murders. One partner has killed the other. But in this case, there were other possible theories as to whether it had actually been Diane Wells who'd pulled the trigger or other people. And there were several other theories as to who might have pulled the trigger. And that was where the research comes in the book, because some of the theories they talk about in the FBI files, some of them were not talked about. And when I managed to get hold of Frank Worth, the US Marshal, he had a private memoir that he'd written, I guess when he retired. His daughter sent it to me. And he'd written about some of his most memorable cases. And there was a page and a half on the Cecil Wells murder. And he put in his unpublished memoir, so this was his thoughts, you know, regardless of what he said publicly, he said that he thought that Johnny was not guilty of the murder. He also suggested what he thought had happened to the gun, the murder weapon. But more importantly and more interestingly, Frank Worth was the guy who was sent down to Oakland to bring Johnny Warren back to Fairbanks to face trial, or at least to face, you know, police and be charged. And there are pictures of him, which I put in the book, of the two of them on, you know, coming out of the airport. And, you know, Johnny Warren has his hands are cuffed and Frank Worth is walking alongside him. And there was one that his daughter sent me, which was never published for obvious reasons, but the two of them are standing together and they're smiling and laughing. And the daughter told me that he said he thought Johnny Warren was a nice guy, that he actually got on very well with him. They shared an interest in music. And he said publicly, Frank Worth, to the newspaper men, "I don't think Johnny Warren is the guilty man," which of course implies that he thinks Diane Wells is the guilty party, or maybe someone else.
You talk about, or you write about in your book, about Diane couch surfing, essentially, after the murder, not having any income of her own, her and her son. And her son, Markham, was not in the home. It was actually three floors down at her grandmother's home, Francis. So that he did not witness any of this mayhem whatsoever. But Diane gives a key to her friend, William Colombini.
That's right.
So tell us how police find out about this connection and what they make of this connection.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Yes, Markham, which was actually his name, but everyone called him Mark. The Markhams were actually a very prominent family in Seattle, in Washington, and he was named after that family. That was a family connection that went back, but everyone, of course, called him Mark. Yes, luckily, he wasn't there the night of the murder. He was staying with his grandmother a few floors down. But yes, after Diane was arrested, she found herself pretty much in dire straits. She had no money or income of her own. This being the 1950s, you know, she didn't have a joint bank account, no credit cards. You know, there was nowhere for her to go to get money out to, you know, buy food and to live. Right. She obviously couldn't go back to the apartment because that was a crime scene. So she ended up staying with some friends or couch surfing and borrowing money and actually selling some of her possessions because she literally had no money. And one of her best friends, we would say the best male friend, was William Colombini, who was a dance instructor. He had, it wouldn't be a ballroom dancing, but he, in his apartment, he lived in the Northwood Building as well. The Northwood Building was the fashionable building in Fairbanks. He had come up from Anchorage about a year or two before, and he taught ballroom dancing lessons in his apartment, which Cecil and Diane took. They took dancing lessons from him, and I have some in the book. I show some of the ads that Columbity placed in the local paper. And, you know, it's, again, it's the 1950s, you know, ballroom dancing and the idea of going out dancing, it was a very big social thing. So they took lessons from him and they became friends and then began to hang out socially. Columbity became part of the Chamber of Commerce, which was Cecil was the chairman of. So they got to know each other. They were neighbors and they were friends and they socialized together. And he stepped in and really helped out with Diane and with Mark, the boy, because he was only three, and really helped out and was really sort of, he went back to the apartment, got some clothes and things for her because she didn't want to, helped with other friends. And it was, he was certainly one of her best friends, which, as you can imagine, over time, some people questioned and they wondered whether they were perhaps more than friends. William Columbity was the hardest to find a lot of information about because he was born in Guatemala. So his name was actually Guillermo Borias Columbany. That was his actual name, but he anglicized it when he came to the US. It was very difficult to find anything about him at all in terms of history-wise because he was, you know, in the papers for this period in relation to this murder, but almost at no other time. But I did manage to track down his daughter and granddaughter. Now, the granddaughter spoke, we spoke several times, and she knew absolutely nothing about her grandfather, absolutely nothing at all. Her mother would not talk about it. So that would be his, you know, Columbity's daughter. She never talked about him, would not talk about it, got very upset whenever he was talked about. And I wondered why that was the case. Was that related to this murder? But it was actually related to William Columbity's past, it seems, according to the Columbity family, that he'd been involved in a murder before back in Guatemala. Now, I have proof of any of this at all, but the Columbity descendants said that he had stepped out on his wife. He was having an affair and that the woman he was having an affair with killed his wife and then they ran away together. Now, I couldn't prove it in any way. And the information I could get, it seemed to be perhaps more a story related to them feeling that, you know, more metaphorically he killed the relationship and the family rather than she was actually killed. But either way, the Columbity family who were around today knew absolutely nothing about any of his life after he left Guatemala in, you know, back in the 30s or the 40s, after this marriage ended in whichever way it ended. But he ended up, as a lot of people do, with many of these stories that are featured in the podcast and that we read about, people often go very long distances to try and start again with a new life and maybe a new name and a new identity. So within the US, it tends to be California is a very common one. Sometimes it's Florida. You know, often it can be Alaska as well. People go a very, very long way to try and start again. And I think that's what William Columbity did. He went to Anchorage first, which was and is still by far the biggest heavily populated town in Alaska. He opened a dance school there. He was married for about a year. And then he and his wife divorced. He sold the dance studio to her. And then he moved to Fairbanks, which, as I mentioned before, it was a hop in town. There may not have been a lot of people there, but there was a lot of money and a lot of people that had time to spend it. You know, Fairbanks is in the interior of Alaska. There's not many places you can go from it to spend money. So people had a lot of money and the only places to really go were local clubs and bars. So he started up a dance school, of which there were several within Fairbanks. And that's how he got to know Diane and Cecil. And over the next 6 months after the murder, through the initial bail and then moving further on in the story, when Diane and Mark leave Alaska on bail and come down to Los Angeles, he follows soon after. So Columbany, he doesn't live with them. His mother lives down in Los Angeles. So he lived with his mother. His sister also lived in Los Angeles at the time. But he came down to Los Angeles as well and basically looked after Diane. He was her consort or her friend. He looked after Mark. He took Mark to school. You know, he was certainly, at least to my mind, a very good friend. However, of course, other people thought, is there more to it than that? Is he more than a friend? Was he more than a friend? Was he involved in what happened?
In preparing for this trial, we have Ted Stevens, the district attorney, and you also have this Evie Danforth. What were some of the specific things that Danforth was trying to put across in his theory? And what happened as a result of the autopsy in terms of issues like time of death? Tell us what Danforth felt were the strongest points in order to be able to prosecute them for the murder.
Yes, that was one of the areas where the differing opinions amongst law enforcement really came into play here. Ted Stevens is was a very, very famous person in Alaskan history. At the time, this was his first appointment straight out of university. I mean, he'd only been practicing for 6 months when he got this job as a DA in Fairbanks. You know, obviously not the most glamorous location or appointment, but it was his starting career. And he ended up being the longest standing, I think it's the senator for Alaska. I mean, the airport in Anchorage is named after him. He became immensely influential in his future career in politics generally. But at the time, he was just a new lawyer and this was a big case. As a DA, this was a huge case that he'd only just started the job. Danforth, the chief of police, had only just started the job as well. And so they both knew it was a big case. But initially, they did seem to, as you say, after the autopsy, seem to disagree about the time of death. Now, which seems odd for us to hear when, you know, when the person who performs the autopsy gives a time of death, you assume that they're the ones who are the most informed and well aware. But Danforth and Stevens seem to disagree. They seem to get it, as is the case with these things. It's only a few hours difference. But if you take it that Diane regained consciousness, like she said she did, and immediately went for help at around 7 o'clock in the morning, what time did they think the murder had happened? Was it 2 hours before, 4 hours before, 5 hours before? We know that they had had dinner with their friend late the night before. So it was sometime between that time. So the autopsy even went into stomach contents and looking at what Cecil had eaten and how much it had been digested and how many hours that meant and what that meant, how long it's since he'd been digested, since he'd gone to sleep, since he was killed and so forth. And it was a 3 or 4 hour period that they seemed to disagree about. And it doesn't seem a big thing in the scheme of things, but then you go through the photographs because obviously the apartment was photographed. And as part of an example of how these small police forces in Alaska especially were very much underfunded, they got the local photographer to come in and take the photographs. So there was no photographer on staff for crime scene. They called the local portrait photographer, which was very standard, very not unusual at all. So he came in and took photographs of the apartment, of the dead body. Some of the pictures are in the book. Took pictures of every room in the apartment, you know, for evidence, some pictures of evidence and so forth. And some of the things that were noticed in the photographs, for example, the curtains were open in the bedroom where Cecil was murdered. Now, usually at nighttime, people tend to close the curtains. Or were the curtains open because someone needed light to see, perhaps? If they needed light to see, what time of day was that? It can't have been the middle of the night. So was it the early hours of the morning? In which case, was that Cecil who opened the windows? Or was somebody looking out or somebody looking in? And nobody saw or heard a gunshot through the window and didn't see through where the curtains were. But then the building, their apartment within the building, the Northwood building's kind of a bit shaped like an H, was on the inside of the H. So you'd have had to have been walking past right at a certain angle to see a gunshot. You see a flash if there was one. And so they started to disagree about that. The main disagreement they had, though, was who was in charge. Because without delving too far into the politics of it, Alaska was a territory. It wasn't a state. So federal crimes, like murder, tended to be handed over to the FBI, often, depending what it was. Now, this case, certainly, because he was a very prominent figure, but that didn't necessarily happen so quickly. And Chief of Police Danforth was pretty adamant. I am the chief of police here. This is a city crime. It's my city. It happened in this city. This is my crime. I'm leading the investigation. So you had him, you had Stevens, the DA, you had the state troopers as well, you had the FBI, possibly sniffing around already, understandably. There were US Marshals as well. A lot of people served a number of functions. And information started not necessarily to not get shared, but not disseminated quickly enough. And it started to get a bit squabbly, let's just say, which is very common even today with investigations. However, at the time, of course, they felt that they had a man that was potentially on the run. Johnny Warren, you know, had left town in a car. He was out of the state. He was in Canada. They didn't know where he'd gone. So he'd gone. So then you had Diane Wells, who was here, who was still in hospital. She was in hospital for a day or two after the murder. And she had been clearly beaten. You know, she had two black eyes. She had cuts on her face. And, you know, it wasn't just a minor tap, but she'd been clearly attacked by somebody, which meant potentially either their murderer was gone or there was a murderer who was still on the loose. And there had been a couple of other home invasion shootings and murders in Fairbanks in recent months. And people actually were scared. People got scared and were starting to wonder what's going on. The police aren't being effective. Who's in charge? Who's running this? And it started to get, let's just say there were a lot of squabbles going on. And they did start to focus on Diane and Johnny as their potential suspects. But again, they didn't have a gun. They also needed to find out what the motive might be. You know, what would the motive be for her to do it? And was it possible that two men had broken in, or was it somebody else? And those were all things that they had to consider. And they kind of looked at in the files, as I discuss, like a lot of cases, it seemed pretty early on that they were fairly focused on Diane and Johnny, but Diane especially.
Let's use this as an opportunity, James, to stop to hear from our sponsor, which is Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 97% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women ages 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. Ritual invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. It was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. My wife Lisa and I were very impressed from the start with Ritual's successful clinical trials and Ritual's scientific approach. And she decided first to try Ritual's Essential for Women 18 plus. She was again impressed with the results. And I started to take Ritual for Men 50 plus when it became available, and we both continued to see a significant difference every day. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, James, you spoke about the momentum to take by Ted Stevens and the prosecution to take Johnny Warren and Diane Wells to court for the murder of Cecil Wells. So that trial is set for April 1954. Tell us what happens with other information coming in. And we didn't talk about that Chief Danforth is forced or encouraged to resign.
Yes, that's right. Within less 6 weeks of the murder, E.V. Danforth resigns as chief of police. It's the same day, actually, that the piece about the murder with photographs is in Newsweek, because they covered the story in Life and Newsweek and Jet with some photographs and talking about what had happened, which I managed to find those old magazines on eBay. And again, it can't be emphasized, this was unusual to have a story from Alaska being featured in those magazines. And the pulp detective magazines, of course, of which there were dozens around at the time, did focus on lots of stories, lots of lurid crime stories with plenty of photographs. But this one was a little unusual because it came from Alaska, which is not usually something they focused on. Yeah, so on the 30th of November, Danforth resigned. He gave a couple of interviews afterwards saying that he felt he could have solved it. He felt he was in the right direction. He felt that he was going to bring everything to justice and that he had done the right thing. But the city fathers or a city manager and the other law enforcement agencies were not so happy with what he was doing. He was quite aggressive and pushy, and it had become a big story. It had gone outside of his realm of just being a local crime. And there was a big push to get a result here, to get a conviction quickly. Because again, always in the background is, you know, Alaska's trying to be a state. And so when a story makes the national newspapers in the US about Cecil Wells, who was essentially a politician from Alaska being killed in his home, and they haven't found out who's done it. And not only was the person who did it, you know, the young blonde wife, but she was having an affair with a black musician. It sounds like a film noir story, and that doesn't go down too well with those who might say clutch their pearls or feel that, you know, Alaska is a, a good functioning part of the US territories that they want to become a state. So the tip came in, they looked into Johnny. Johnny went voluntarily with the police. What he told them pretty much made up the mind for everybody. The indictments, there was a grand jury. It was done in secret in Fairbanks. The arrest warrants were issued for both Johnny and Diane, by which time Diane had left Fairbanks. She had flown down to Seattle en route to LA. As anyone who's ever traveled up to Alaska knows, almost everything goes through Seattle.
Right.
You have to go through Seattle. There's very few places that are direct. But she was arrested off the plane at Seattle. She was carrying Mark in her arms. She was arrested at the airport and taken straight down into the local courts there, told what was happening, told what she'd been charged with, told that she was going to be extradited because, again, extradited because it was a territory, not a state, so it was slightly different. And then she was put straight back on the plane the next day. She and Mark, they were allowed to go by themselves without a U.S. marshal. So when they got back to Fairbanks, again, at the airport, the newspaper men were waiting and they took lots of pictures. There aren't an enormous amount of pictures of Diane Wells at that time. Her family, her eldest daughter, managed to give me quite a few. And some of Cecil's family members managed to give me some pictures of Cecil and Diane on holiday and so forth. So that's from that era. But the actual pictures from around the arrest are the classic kind of film noir. She's blonde hair. She's got a fur coat on and she's coming down off the plane or she's standing up against a wall. I picked a particularly striking image for the cover of the book where she's standing against the wall with her sort of arms around herself. And there are two newspaper men in front of her taking pictures.
Right.
And she looks particularly harried. And this was the time when it was certainly becoming clear that this was taking a real toll, as it would do on anyone, that she was getting extremely upset and distressed and becoming very upset about what was going to happen to Mark, to her son especially. And as I found out later from her eldest daughter, she had had some issues in previous years. There'd been some postnatal depression, which it wasn't really known as back then. This is again in the 40s and 50s, possibly even some mental health issues as well. And it began a downward spiral for her. I mean, it's going to be a bit of a, you know, spoiler alert, but it began a bit of a downward spiral for her. So she was taken back to Fairbanks. She was charged. They set the date for the trial. The date for the trial was moved so many times for various reasons. But because the date had been set and she had the money, or rather Cecil's family, the family lawyer, that she was out on bail. She could afford the $5,000 to $10,000 that it cost cumulatively to be out on bail. Now, again, I know we think, well, how can you possibly get out on bail if you're charged with murder? And we know it can happen.
Right.
And again, this was territorial Alaska. Plus, I'm sure they assumed, well, what's she going to do? She's not going to flee the country. You know, she doesn't have any money. Where's she going to go? So she immediately left Fairbanks with Mark and came down to Los Angeles, where she'd been actually before as a much younger woman, I learned. And I think she really came down to Los Angeles because she felt she could lose herself in the city. There was 2 million people in Los Angeles. You know, it's, of course, it's a million times bigger today, but I really think she felt she could lose herself in Los Angeles because in Fairbanks, it was gossip central. You know, you have to remember from the first time that, you know, she and Cecil had arrived in town, people were like, who is this young trophy wife? You know, and that's what everybody said. And that's what everybody thought, you know, and that was the relationship they had. You know, Cecil bought her lots of jewelry and furs and clothes. And she was the hostess, you know, with the mostess, as they say. And that was their relationship. And so she felt that she was condemned, you know, pretty much condemned, certainly in the public eye. And you can imagine with Life and Newsweek and the pulp magazines especially, you know, they absolutely went to town. You know, she was the perfect villain for this, you know, a young blonde, you know, with everything to gain, his $1 million fortune, which was talked about all the time. And Cecil was a wealthy man per se. He had lots of assets and he had land and so forth. But of course, as is often the case, she didn't get any of the money because she was the executor of his will. But of course, when she was arrested, that was taken away from her. She wasn't allowed to do that. So she didn't get this enormous payoff that people thought she did get. You know, there was money put aside for Mark, you know, when he turned 21, but of course he was only 3. So he wasn't going to get that money for years. There was money put aside for him to live on and so forth in Cecil's will. But it wasn't like Diane suddenly had lots of money and got his fortune. So she moved down to Los Angeles and she stayed with a couple of friends of hers and Cecil's who put her up for several months. And she came down and enrolled Mark in school. And William Calamberi came soon afterwards. And it seemed that for several months, she seemed to be kind of getting on with life as much as she could. And then, as you said, the trial date was announced. And, you know, they were saying, it's definitely happening. It's definitely happening. We're definitely going to trial in April. And that was 2 or 3 months away was when they got the time. And I think that was possibly a moment when she started to really think about the future and be concerned and really think about what was at risk and what she thought might happen.
What happens as a result, despite William Calamberi helping her in every way he could and supporting her and sticking with her? They go out to a movie one night. Mm. She's staying at a hotel, at the Drake Hotel.
Yeah.
Under an alias, you write. Tell us what happens.
Yeah. So it was March the 8th, 1954. So less than a month before the trial, Diane was already taking medication for depression, for nerves, as they called it in those days. And that's barbiturates. So she was already taking medication. William Calamberi and the friends that she was staying with, a couple, they had both been worried about her. They had actually taken pills off her when she seemed to be particularly unhappy, and they had been taking them off her and not letting her go out with the many pills, more pills than she's allowed to take. But I would imagine that after several months staying with her two friends, maybe she wanted some more space. Or maybe she felt she'd outstayed her welcome. She moved into a hotel on Hollywood Boulevard. I walked past it last night. It's still there, the building. It's not a hotel anymore, but the building is still there. It's called the Drake Hotel. And she moved into a room there, and she moved in around about Valentine's Day. And there's a reason we know that she moved in around about Valentine's Day. So she moved into a room in the hotel. Now, there are a number of reasons she could have moved into a hotel herself. You know, I said it could have been, you know, that you get more privacy. You also get, you know, there's probably a phone line that you might be able to use. You might be able to receive calls, make calls without anyone overhearing. I mean, it could be a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. Either way, she was staying in the hotel. And then on March the 8th, William Calamberi, they went out to see a movie, their evening screening. And, you know, he said, is everything all right? It was, you know, is everything fine? She said it was all great. And unfortunately, he took her back to the hotel. And she immediately checked out of the Drake Hotel and walked about 3 or 4 blocks down to Hollywood and Vine and turned south. And again, the building is still there. It's called the Hollywood Plaza Hotel. And that was a very, very fancy hotel back in the day, very famous. It's not a hotel anymore, but the building's still there. And she checked into a room there. And you can probably see where this is going, but she checked into a room there. And spoiler alert, I hope it's not going to ruin the book for anyone, but that night she took a large dose of her barbiturates. She left 3 notes in the Drake Hotel. 2 of them were to William Calamberi. One of them was thanking him for everything he'd done, asking him to look after Mark and, you know, that she really appreciated him as a friend and so forth, which I thought was significant because it was not a loving letter. It was not someone that I felt someone that you were in love with or loved or right. had a sort of an emotion, anything more than a friendship with. Mm-hmm. She left another letter addressed to 2 other friends, asking them to raise Mark as their own son. And she wrote another one. Well, the last one was virtually incoherent, but it was kind of the one that everyone was waiting for, was the sort of semi-confession. Now, you can read, I put, you know, pictures of the notes in the book. And, you know, as hard as it is to imagine, they published them in the newspapers as well. I mean, the newspapers back in the day, back then in the 50s, Los Angeles had a lot of newspapers and they were very competitive and crime was a big seller. And they would show, you know, they would show dead bodies and they would put suicide notes and stuff like that. Things that we can't possibly imagine today, but mm-hmm. they did then. So all the suicide notes were put in the paper for people to read. And the last one, it seems that she wrote, the one that she left at the Hollywood Plaza Hotel in her room, sort of said along the lines of, if Johnny's guilty, then I'm guilty. You know, if I'm guilty of anything, Cecil is dead, so I must kind of be guilty. It's not a clear confession. And, you know, like I said, barely legible, but it certainly seems to show that if nothing else, she feels guilty for what happened. And she also made clear in one of the other suicide notes that she did not want Mark, her son, her and Cecil's son, to go through the trial, to go through any of this. She felt she wanted to protect him. And unfortunately, she really thought that the best way to protect him would be for her to to take an overdose. And that's what happened. The next day, believe it or not, as tragic as it sounds, as if you couldn't write it, but William Colombani and Anne, the friend of that they'd been staying with, that Diane had been staying with, were worried. They had been worried the night before, and they went round to the Drake Hotel just to check she was all right in the morning. And of course, they told her she'd gone. And they arrived at the Hollywood Plaza Hotel just as they were wheeling the body out. Wow. There's actually a picture in the LA Times that I found. As I say, they would show the pictures, but there's a low trolley and they're pulling a body out with a white sheet. And there's a guy with his back to the camera, and that's William Colombani. So he got there just to find out. I mean, because they basically said, do you know who this is for him? And he was like, he didn't want to think it was her, but it was. So she committed suicide. And that, you would have thought, would have been the end of it, really. But of course, it led to a lot of other things. I mean, for instance, now Mark, the son, who was still not yet four, now is the entire heir to the estate. So there was then a bit of a custody battle over him. And I did speak to Mark just once. I did manage to find him and speak to him a little about what had happened. He was, and again, it's a bit of a spoiler alert, but I did speak to him briefly about it. It became clear that he'd not had a happy life, and that the death, obviously, of his father and his mother had deeply affected his life, and not for the good in any way whatsoever. And he initially seemed very keen to talk. He really seemed to want the story to come out. He felt that there was a big story to tell, but then he wrote me a letter, said he couldn't do it, which I understood. And I haven't been in touch with him since. I think he's somewhat in touch with his half sisters. I guess they'd be half sisters, Diane's children from a previous marriage. They were in touch a little bit, but I don't think a great deal. So I figured, like a lot of these things, I wasn't a member of the family. So I never felt it was my position to try and affect any sort of communication or reunitings, that kind of thing. I really didn't think that was my business. I thought if I write the book and put everything down that I found, the people who are interested can read it and find out what they want to find out. And I know that there are lots of things in this book that these family members, Cecil's family, Diane's family, Johnny's family, Comedy's family, I know there's things in there that they don't know about their relatives, and they're going to read it and hear. And that was one of the most, that was one of the toughest things in writing the book, was what would they think when they read it? Would they believe me? Would they think I was just making it up? Would they think that I'd got it wrong? Because, as you can imagine, you don't want to read that perhaps your mother was a killer who committed suicide. You don't want to think that. You might think, well, it was somebody else. There were other theories about what happened to Cecil, which I talk about in the book. I devoted chapters at each one at the end, because I go through chronologically what happened. Several people thought it was a hitman. It was related to organized crime. Some people thought that it was Johnny. Some people thought it was Johnny because Cecil had confronted him, or there'd been a row, or there'd been an argument. Some people thought that it was Colombani. Some people thought that it was Colombani who had done it out of valor or jealousy or in the spur of the moment. Some people thought it was a robbery. There were a number of people, and I talk about them in the book, who committed a lot of crimes locally and were armed. And there had been murders, in-home invasions. Some people really thought it was what she said. And she said all the way through, right to the end, she said, two men broke in and they shot him and they beat me up. So then you sort of move further on to what happens to Johnny, and he spends the next 6 years pretty much. He doesn't stay in Fairbanks. The last time I saw him in there was probably, I think it was the late 50s.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. You talk about Johnny for the next 7 years, despite Diane committing suicide. You would have thought that this was the end of this indictment and this cloud of suspicion over Johnny. How long does it take, and what are the circumstances in which these charges are finally dismissed against him?
Yes, you would have thought that was very much the end of it. And there were I read some letters and some telegraph cables and things at the time after her suicide, where they were pretty much saying the case is over. We really didn't have, it was going to be a 50-50 deal in the end, and now we don't have her. And she was the last one to see him alive. She was the witness. She had been there at the alleged break-in, and she's gone. There'd never really been publicly at least, a real sort of sense that they really felt that Johnny was the evil man here, or that he was an equal villain. You know, she had been dismissed as, you know, the grasping, you know, gold-digging blonde who'd, of course, killed her rich husband. You know, maybe he had not been the best husband and it had been in a moment of passion, but still she'd done it. Him, you know, he wasn't the spurned lover. You know, this wasn't the great love affair of all ages. You know, they'd only met a couple of months before. But needless to say, as I found out from the files, they kept investigating the case. That it was active way up until after Alaska became a state in 59. And I think that was probably what was really the end of it. Because as I found out, going through the archives and dealing with the archives, is there's a very big line and a big difference between territorial and state. You know, when you're trying to get, for example, you know, freedom of information requests and documents and stuff out of territorial records, that can be difficult. State records, absolutely first class. They've got everything ordered because they were a state. And I think they kind of drew a line under everything. And that included the Johnny Warren arrest and the indictment, because it was still in the papers, in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, which was the big paper in Fairbanks and still is. They still mentioned it whenever there was a grand jury, which used to run every year, once a year for a few weeks in Fairbanks. Because again, it's not a huge court system. This is in the 50s. It would always be mentioned. And there's still the Johnny Warren case, you know, with the murder of Cecil Wills, because it was still a huge deal, because the suicide had been a big story as well. That was the one that had made it as far as Australia. You know, because now we had the tragedy of suicide, the tragedy of, you know, unfortunately, they called him the poor little orphan boy, you know, the poor little millionaire boy. You know, that was Mark. So they had kept talking about bringing it to trial, bringing Johnny to trial, and it never happened. And then there's just a document in the FBI files that has the indictment, and there's a big rubber stamp on it that says exonerated. And there's a short document that just says, you know, we're dropping the charges to be discontinued, the investigation will be discontinued. And that was it. And he was a free man. And I speculate in the book, how did he find out? You know, what did he think? And the only way I really found out was because he's no longer alive anymore, as almost all of the people who are involved at the time are no longer with us. But I did speak to Johnny Warren. He did have one child. He had a child very late in life. He was actually married five times as well, ironically. But his fifth wife was younger than him. And he had a child later in life. And the child's younger than me, my child. He's a man, obviously, but he's younger than me. And I met him. I managed to track him down. And I asked him about, you know, his father. And did his father ever talk about this? You know, why on earth would he? But did he ever mention, you know, that back in the 50s, you know, I was involved in this big case in Fairbanks or anything like that? And of course, his name is John as well, of course. John said, no, he never mentioned it to me. He never mentioned it to my mother. And the only way they found out about it was when Johnny passed away. They were going through his effects and his papers, and he had kept a copy of Life magazine, which had the photographs and the story about the murder in it, which of course had pictures of him in it as well, you know, in handcuffs. And he kept that all his life and never said a word about it.
Wow.
So I wondered what he thought and whether he really was involved in any way and what happens. And again, that's what I talk about in the book is, it's the last few chapters. I look at the potential theories and see, is it possible? Is it feasible that William Colombani was involved? Is it possible that Johnny Warren was involved? Was it a break-in? Was it a random event? Was it a hitman? Was it related to organized crime? Because I had to look into that. You know, again, it's, you know, territorial Alaska in the 50s in Fairbanks, you know, a town of, you know, less than 10,000 people. How much money can there be? Well, the thing is, it doesn't matter. If there's lots of bars and restaurants and hotels and lots of people around with lots of money to spend. I mean, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, there was actually, a red light district in Fairbanks that was all brothels, well-maintained, well-run, properly organized, that was for all the men who were there. And, you know, it even had like a door you could go in separately. You know, so there was money there, and there was organized crime in, you know, in Oregon and Seattle. And, you know, it's not a big leap to think that it could have happened. And if Cecil had learned about it, he was a politically or civically minded man. He might have gone to the police. He might have gone to the police about it. So I look into that possible scenario. But in the end, you know, I come to the conclusion that I think is probably the most likely as to what happened on October the 17th, 1953.
You write about what you believe happened. And you go back to Diane being beaten up. And it seems strange that somebody, an assailant, a professional hitman, as it looked like, or it was depicted as, would leave her as a witness. Yet she was not, as in some cases it would be seen closer to recently, some of these people that claim to be a victim aren't very beat up. She was definitely beaten by someone. What is your idea about at least Diane's guilt in this?
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's the thing. You see the pictures of her, and there's a couple of pictures in the book. You know, she looks like, you know, to do a sort of horrible, she looks like, a panda. You know, she's got two black eyes. She looks like, you know, she's been heavily beaten in the face. You know, I mean, we've all probably, some of us have black eyes in the past. And I think if you get punched right on the nose, you can get two black eyes. But two black eyes is usually unusual. Now, when she said she was attacked by one of the two men who broke in, she said that she was just hit by like a flower pot, which, I mean, there's actually, you know, because they take pictures of the flower pot and stuff. And I'm talking like one of those small flower pots you might put a cactus in, not like a huge ones that, you know, that you have the large, like a Busy Lizzie or something. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the small little ones that you have a cactus in. And and at the time, E.V. Danforth, the chief of police, was like, well, I didn't see, you know, any dirt on the floor. I didn't see any dirt in her hair. I didn't see like the plant anywhere. You know, she was supposed to have been hit and this thing cracked on her head. Now, sure, a ceramic flower pot cracked on your head would certainly hurt and maybe cut you and give you a bump, maybe even knock you out. But to give two black eyes seemed unusual, seemed maybe not to add up so much. And as you said, if there were other people involved in this, if this was a hit, a professional hit, why would they have left her alive? If it was made to look like a professional hit, why didn't they tie her up, throw her in the closet, and then kill Cecil so that she could genuinely say, help get me out of the closet. I didn't see anything. Two men came in, put a blindfold in, threw me in the closet.
Right.
You could do the same thing if it was a setup by her to have him murdered, which some people thought, you know, that she arranged for Cecil to be killed. Why not do it better than that to make her to be absolutely clear of any guilt? So, you know, I guess it's only when, and like I say, I think I'm probably the only person who's ever assembled everything, you know, to look at it this way. But now with the benefit of hindsight, you know, you have to remember in the 1950s that the term domestic abuse, that didn't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't know what that was. I mean, it was a very different time where, you know, giving a child a spanking was, you know, seen as good parenting.
Yeah.
You know, also, you know, if a husband was to hit his wife, that was something between them. That wasn't necessarily considered to be too much of a problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially if there was alcohol involved, you know, and unfortunately it's the same today. You know, police today will go on domestic calls and we'll see that there's evidence of abuse. But if the wife doesn't say anything or the husband doesn't say anything or the child, they can't press charges. So it's not especially unusual to us, but you look back with some benefit of hindsight, you look at the picture of her, you look at what the neighbors said who were canvassed after the murder and were witnesses or gave witness statements. Several of them said, we hear shouting, we hear the sound of screaming, we hear what could be fighting, you know, we hear crying women, crying children, whatever was going on in there, you know, there was something, a disagreement or two. And I also did speak to a couple of people who were still quite elderly now, who were around at the time, who were adults at the time and knew Cecil and Diane. And there were a couple of them that said to me, oh yeah, he did hit her. Now, whether he was a serial, you know, abuser, a serial violent man, I don't know, but there were definitely indications that he hit his wife. And a couple of people said to me, you know, if he'd had too much to drink, sometimes that was when it would come out. And as we know, looking back again at the report, they'd been out the night before, had several drinks because they checked, because the Northwood building had a bar in the bottom. So they'd been into the bar within the building, then gone back up to the room. They'd had several drinks there. Then they had drinks in the apartment with their late guest who came to visit. Then he'd had another drink before going to bed. And it was really when I spoke to a friend of mine who, well, he's a friend now. He used to work for the LAPD. And I sent him a couple of the crime scene photographs without any context at all.
Right.
And I said, what do you make of this woman here? And he said to me, he asked the circumstances, much as similar as we've discussed. And he said, well, he said, you know, having had 20, 30 years as a policeman, he said it was pretty apparent to me that she's an abused wife. She's been beaten up by her husband. She said, because I saw it many times in work when I was on patrol. And as we know, again, because we've heard it many times, sometimes it's the wife, sometimes it's the husband will say, two men broke in and killed XYZ, insert name here. You know, you watch a lot of, you know, the true crime documentaries and the podcasts. And
sure,
so often people say, this man broke in. This man just broke in and just shot me. Or just shot me, and you know, I survived, but she's dead. And that's what he said. It was such a common excuse that men and sometimes the women and sometimes men would say, you know, two men broke in. I don't know who they were. Strangers broke in and beat me up and shot him. And so once you start to sort of tie those bits together, plus there was even a call, and again, it's somewhat speculation, but the witness accounts or the police report of the murder did mention that at one stage, Diane had called the equivalent of CPS, like Child Protective Services.
Right.
Now, of course, that could have been, as I say in the book, that could have been about a million things. It could have been about all sorts of things. She could have had a friend there that she called to say hello. However, when you read some of the witness statements about how they heard Mark crying and children shouting, you just wonder. And then it isn't too hard to go from a scenario there, as I do pretty much in the last chapter of the book, as to what might have happened late that evening on October the 16th, going into the 17th. You know, they were out drinking, they'd been out, they stayed up late. Maybe they had a row, maybe they didn't. She got up sometime during the night, was sick on her pajamas. And that was always an important thing, because the police lost the pajamas or didn't gather them properly.
Yes.
Only got the set that she was wearing when in the morning. And they did have them analyzed, and they found that the blood on the pajamas was hers. You know, and so you think, well, how did her blood get on unless she'd really been beaten up or someone had attacked her? And so it did kind of line up. And then you just think, well, maybe. And I like I said, I won't do the whole scenario, but I kind of did an imaginary scenario as what might have happened. And I think it was probably ultimately, sadly, a story that we've heard a million times before, where an abused partner, whether it was the first time or the 100th time, decided that, you know, they'd had enough and decided to do something about it. And maybe it was meant to be. I don't think it was a brutal, you know, lying in wait, premeditated thing.
Right.
I don't think it was that. And I think probably she may have just wanted to scare him, or she may have wanted to hurt him, but not kill him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows? And I think what happened is she did that, realized what she'd done. And then I think she made a couple of phone calls to friends. And I think possibly that friend included William Colomboli. He lived in the same building. They mm-hmm. they were very good friends. And I think more than likely she might have talked to him about the situation at home. You know, because a lot of the time people don't say anything, but people know. There were a couple of other family friends that came around later, and they were interviewed by the police, you know, and clear that of having an involvement in the murder, but they were caught. They did come round later, and they were friends of Cecil and Diane, and they may well have known perhaps what had been happening. And they might have sat there and said, look, we'll try and sort this out. It's going to be okay. We'll try and sort this out. And, you know, things didn't go to plan.
Yes.
But like I say, it could have been something completely different. But in many ways, you know, there's only so much you can get out of newspapers, but you look at the pictures and you see her, and like, she was definitely beaten up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't imagine, you know, that Johnny Warren came round and, you know, in his passion beat her up. I can't imagine that, you know, William Colomboli came round and she said, you know, I've shot my husband, you know, beat me up to make it look like it was a break-in. You know,
yes.
I just can't imagine that, you know, he would have like, okay, stand there and let me punch you in the face a few times. You know, which someone said that was possible, you know, that it was a setup. But, you know, it's usually, you know, the Occam's razor, the most obvious explanation. It is probably the most likely. And once you've eliminated all the others, and, you know, it's sadly, it's a scenario that we still see played out, you know, every day, today. And that was really one of the things that interested me in the story right back at the beginning, was that I thought, if this happened today, even in the same place with the same people and the same looking the same with the same, you know, skin color and the same circumstances, it would be a big media sensation just in the same way.
Yes.
We would look at Diane and we would say, oh, well, she's obviously the gold digging blonde. We would look at Johnny as the, you know, the jazz musician who left town. They go, well, he's obviously got something to do with it, you know, and you'd have looked at the money and you'd have thought, oh, it was all about money. I bet it was the two of them. And that's an end to it. But today, I think we would look a little bit differently and find out more about the relationship between Diane and Cecil and see if there were any contributing factors, as well as external factors like mental health issues, or, you know, she could have been on tablets for depression for years, as far as we knew. You know, living in Fairbanks, it wasn't really something I addressed so much earlier, but living in Fairbanks or in Alaska, you know, that's a tough life. It's very, very different to anything else. I can't pretend that I know, you know, how it is. But from what I gathered on my trip there, you know, Alaskans often tend to consider themselves, you know, Alaskans first, then Americans. You know, they are literally separated from America, much like Hawaii. You know, they consider themselves to be separate and different. And, you know, they're very self-reliant, and it can be a very tough life. And you may have to rely on your neighbors one day to save your life, you know.
Yes.
And there's a lot of things that are sorted out privately and go unsaid. But I think today we might have looked into that. But for someone who comes up there, and, you know, Diane went up there and she was, you know, 29, 28. You know, she went up there. She had two daughters from a previous marriage who I have mentioned. Now, she was estranged from them. She'd had a very difficult divorce from her first husband. She was estranged from her daughters. I think probably not by her doing, but she was estranged from her daughters. So she goes up to Fairbanks, which is in the middle of Alaska, you know, and the weather conditions there can be very challenging. And life was very challenging there. And, you know, it was a very big change from living in, you know, Portland, where she was born, and Seattle, where she'd spent a lot of her time. You know, it's a very different lifestyle, and it's a struggle. It's a struggle. I'm sure she struggled to settle in. And plus, you know, as people will see in the book, you know, she was an exceptionally attractive woman. She would have got a lot of attention from the start. I mean, even, you know, that was the thing. Both the men and the women that I interviewed all said, oh, she was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. She was the most beautiful woman in Fairbanks by miles. You know, so I think she would have got a lot of attention. And that might have been tricky if, you know, she'd have had a husband who was maybe jealous or possessive, or, you know, or realized that he was 20 years, you know, older than her, and he might have not shared the same interests, you know. And she was, you know, she was a homemaker like so many women would have been at the time. And perhaps she felt she wanted a little more, but she was stuck in a little town. That could have had an effect. You know, the weather can affect people in Alaska. You know, there's months of endless sun and the months of dark. That's a medical condition. You know, people can be affected by that, and that may have all come into play.
Yes. I want to thank you so much, James T. Bartlett, for coming on and talking about your extraordinary The Alaskan Blonde: Sex, Secrets, and the Hollywood Story That Shocked America. For those that might want to find out more information about this, is there a website for this book?
Yes, of course. These days we're on social media. Pretty much everything is The Alaskan Blonde, blonde with an E, but the website is thealaskanblonde.com. And then there's Facebook and Instagram, and Twitter is AlaskanBlonde53. But yes, there's a lot online, and I'm going to put a lot more up, because especially on the website, because so much I couldn't get into the book, but there was really so much here, and I hope I've scratched the surface in some way.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. The Alaskan Blonde: Sex, Secrets, and the Hollywood Story That Shocked America. James T. Bartlett. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you.